Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, Lama Kathy Wesley gives a talk entitled, Bringing Your Light to the World. In observance of the Western New Year, the Columbus KTC Dharma community participates in a lamplighting ceremony in which we pray for peace and goodness in the world. In advance of this occasion, Lama Kathy explains the significance of light in Buddhist teachings and how we can nurture our own inner light and use it to bring goodness to ourselves and others. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Now, today, because the New Year prayer, the New Year's Day prayer, is prayer for light, I thought it would be useful to offer a couple of things today about Buddhist teachings on light and on goodness, because we all need a little bit more of both. We need more light and we need more goodness. And so I'd like to talk about bringing the light and how we can bring the light into our own lives and into the lives of others. So I think that's what I'm going to talk about today. So let's start in a very Buddhist way with an intention. Let's make the internal intention that we dedicate this session to the benefit of all suffering beings. I'll be reciting the four-line prayer of taking refuge from the Chenrezig. If it's a prayer you're familiar with, you can join right in on the fa-la-las, you know. Oh, that's Christmas. Anyway, you can join right in. But if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and in your mind and think that you dedicate this session to the benefit of yourself and others. O Sanje Chudang So Chi Cho Nam La Jang Chu Pardu Dan Ni Kyap Su Chi Da Ji Jin So Ji Bei Su Nam Ki Dro La Pin Chi Sanje Dru Pa Sho. O Palin Sawe Lama Rinpo Che Tagi Chi War Pe De Den Shula Kadrin Jinpo Gwane Je Sun Te Kusum tugging o drup sal du so. Okay, thank you. Okay. The teachings of the Buddha are about and are concerned with and are about finding that light and goodness that is within us. And of course, this is based on the Buddha's teaching that all beings have within themselves the potential to awaken, and therefore all beings have what is called in Buddhist terminology, Buddha nature. All beings have Buddha nature. We all have the potential to awaken to our own mind and our own goodness. For many of us, this is merely something that's theoretical. Somebody told us that we have Buddha nature, and we are sometimes willing to entertain the notion, but other times we're not so sure. And we're definitely not sure we can entertain the notion that certain other people have Buddha nature too. I'm just saying. And those certain other people may be people whose behavior we find objectionable. People who have hurt us in the past, people who are hurting us now, people who could hurt us in the future. These are the people for whom we have a difficult time believing in Buddha nature. And so we have to find a way to bring an awareness of Buddha nature to our own mind, and so doing, hopefully show a little bit of that Buddha nature to others. So we were talking about light as an analogy in Buddhism. And I think that that wisdom is associated with light. Our inner wisdom is associated with light, and so on and so on. Why light? Why not something else? And I think the reason for this is that we all have a lot of things that cover up our light. Don't know if this is a news flash for you, but sometimes we have things that cover up our light and make it difficult for us to see and for others to see. I received a letter from a friend who lives in another state recently, and they're having a very, very difficult time in their life. And members of their family are very upset, and there's a lot of drama in the family. And I told her that I would pray for her and the family. But I reminded her, I said, well, just remember that all of these people who are acting out are suffering. And remember that all of them have Buddha nature. It's just that it might be hidden right now. And sometimes it gets hidden under our own ignorance of having Buddha nature. We don't know that we have it, so we naturally look outside of ourselves for the sources of happiness and the causes of happiness and avoiding suffering and so forth. We look outside of ourselves instead of looking within ourselves for the sources of happiness. And so when we project outward, thinking that the sources of happiness are external, we will then spend all of our time trying to accrue and accumulate those things which we think are the causes of happiness, money and friends and situations and status and all of those things we think that will bring us happiness. But the part of us that's not recognizing the Buddha nature is the part of us that is confused. And we're confused about these things. And sometimes we even hurt other people without meaning to. We don't mean to hurt people, but we do hurt them by the things we say and do as we are trying to do the things we think will make us happy. And believe it or not, this is like the human condition. Everybody is suffering from it. The person on your left, the person on your right, the person in front of you, the person behind you, everybody is suffering from this. And not knowing that is a source of darkness for us, because when our habitual thought patterns cover over our light, we can sometimes feel depressed and think there's nothing for us here. Or we can become angry at others and blame others for the things that are happening within us. And so when our light is covered by our habitual patterns, then that is the kind of darkness we want to dispel. And this is the purpose and function of meditation. Because when you're meditating and you're allowing your attention to rest on the breath as it comes in and goes out, or you're using a mantra as your object of meditation, when you're using this object of meditation and letting your attention rest on it, all other thoughts are just going by. As my friend Bradley used to say when he taught meditation, it's not like you're jumping on the floats in the parade and starting to wave. You just let those parade floats go by. And so, I know, I thought that was a good one too, right? You don't jump on them and start waving, which is what happens when you follow a distraction and let it influence you. In any case, these habits that we have can cause us a lot of trouble, because I don't know if you've experienced this, but for me, sometimes one habit leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and the next thing you know, you're in the next county and you wonder how you got there. It's not just my forgetfulness, there's other stuff going on. And so what we're doing in meditation is we're trying to let go of our distractibility in order to come back to the source in the home that is our Buddha nature. And the reason Buddha nature is associated with light is because once we recognize that we have this intrinsic value, that we have this intrinsic potential to be awakened, it's as though everything is illuminated that once was dark. We have a sense that there's hope in our world. There's hope in our life. There's hope in our family. There's hope in our situation. We can actually begin to be, shall we say, agents of change in our own lives. We can actually do something different. I talk to a lot of people about their Dharma practice and their meditation, and frequently they will tell me that the good thing about their meditation is that now they're able to notice their habitual thoughts while they're happening. While they are happening. And they can, at first, it's kind of like your bicycle is heading toward the ditch and you just can't seem to get on the right side of your balance and you know you're going to fall over. And so it's like, oh no, oh no, oh no. But that's how we feel at first when we see our habits coming. We think, oh my gosh, I can't avoid this collision. But over time, we're able to steer ourselves back onto the road and to avoid the ditch. And this is wonderful. It's a good feeling. It's almost like a feeling of freedom. Like, wow, I was able to change something that I thought was unchangeable. And this gives confidence. And this is another reason why light is an example. It illuminates. It can pervade. It can show what was hidden. And it can be a sign for others to see. Frequently, people look at the example of the lighthouse on a shoreline as an example for the spiritual person, the person who's trying to let their light shine so they can be of help to others. Now, you may not feel much like a lighthouse some days, but we all have the potential to illuminate the lives of others, even in just small ways. For example, I was taught, and this is even before Mr. Rogers, I mean, that you can smile at people and that that is a light for them. Because when you're always frowning, there's no light that's going to come out from your face that will inspire other people, because other people are feeling, I don't know if this is news, another news flash, other people feel depressed sometimes. I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of people who walk around feeling sad. And one way to change how we are seen in the world is by smiling at other people. Because when you smile at someone, for a moment, they forget that they are unhappy. They forget their sadness because a smile can be infectious. Of course, I'm not talking about kind of the, like, creepy grin. I'm not talking about that. But just a gentle, loving, caring smile. It's really a wonderful thing. And this is why great Buddhist masters, such as the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, encourages his students to think about smiling when they are going into an interaction with another person, to consider it. Not always appropriate. Smiles are not always appropriate. But where they are appropriate, it can be transformational. And that is one way we can be that lighthouse on the side of the shore. Because we may not have the answers. Again, newsflash, we don't. Because we're only we're still young in our spiritual discipline, so we're not enlightened beings yet. So we can't, our light won't shine that brightly. But even if just a little bit of light comes from us, a little bit of possibility shines from us, from our meditation practice, it might actually inspire someone to ask the question, what is it about you? What do you do? This has actually happened to people I know, that someone that they worked with or someone who had been a friend of theirs for some time came up to them in a totally non-meditation context and said to them, what is it about you? And I remember Kempo Carter Rinpoche told us, he warned us this would happen. He said, if you meditate for any period of time, for any, you know, even short time, long time, 1 year, 1 week, 1 day, at some point somebody's going to ask you what you do, because they are going to see something they are not used to seeing. And when they see that strange thing, which is openness and goodness and non-judgment, which is what comes from meditation, right? You're sitting on your seat. You don't necessarily judge your thoughts. You just let them go. That non-judgment that we train in meditation can be part of that light that we're showing to others. Not just the smile, not just the goodness, but also the fact that we can be approached and we're not dangerous. I mean, really, right? Everybody has somebody in their life or at their workplace who you just don't want to approach. Just doesn't feel safe. In fact, this is, sorry for the digression, I will come back. I was in an office, walking through an office the other day on my way somewhere else, and I saw a weather forecast on the door of the CFO. Sorry about this. Anyhow, she said, you know, like it's like it had storm clouds and lightning coming from the clouds, and it said, today is payroll day, don't bug me. I'm doing payroll today, don't bug me. So she basically was trying to let her coworkers know that this is not a good time, because she has to really make all those figures come out the way they have to come out and be as accurate as she can be. So for her, that's a stressful situation, and she wanted to let everybody know she was feeling stressed. But there are lots of reasons why our light may not shine as brightly on some days as others. But if we have even just a little light, it will help people. And they may ask, well, what is it that you do? And you can say, well, I don't know. I guess maybe it's because I meditate. And then you can let the conversation drop there or go wherever they want you to go with it. Because someone's asked me, well, how come I never see Buddhist evangelists on the street? We sort of like don't do that. We don't do that. We're not trying to play hide the Buddhist center, you know. We're not trying to like hide under a basket or something. We do let people know we exist, and we're on Facebook, and we do all the things you do, right? But by the same token, we're not trying to tell people that they have to think like us or practice like us or do like us. My friends in 12-step recovery, they say that it's a program of attraction, meaning that we let the people who are in recovery let their recovery speak for itself. And so like that, meditation speaks for itself. People will sometimes ask you, what is it that you do? And you go, well, I don't know. Maybe it's because I meditate. And then if they want to talk more about it, they'll talk about it. And if they don't, they'll just let that drop right there. It's often a conversation stopper on airplanes, I'm just saying. So light then, light can refer to our Buddha nature, and it can refer to that quality of goodness that is within all of us that can be gradually accessed through the practice of meditation, because when we let go of our habitual tendencies and we let go of our clinging and fixations and all of the things that cause our suffering, when we let go of these habits, our light shines more brightly. And we have a potential to see more of our minds through this process of letting go. And so that's why we meditate, is to begin to let go of the habits that cause suffering. And when we begin to let go of those habits, we become a person who is approachable and a person who can be trusted and a person who is at the least not harmful and at the best is very helpful. So that's a little bit about light and how to make that light shine. We make our light shine when we choose to benefit others. We make our light shine when we choose to take care of ourselves and to not harm ourselves. We nurture our light when we take a deep breath and actually, like Grandma used to say, count to 10 before we say something that we might later regret. We take time and relax our minds and in so doing change how we're perceived. And we become positive in our workplace, family, and home. But there's more than just being a contributor to the harmony of home and family and work. There's actually more that can be shown in this light. And this is a little bit more of a subtle topic. The reason that that light is used as an analogy is because right now we don't know what is going on inside our minds. We just know that our minds are producing lots of thoughts, lots of feelings, lots of stories, and that we're spending all of our time busily following them. Like they're the tea leaves and we have to read them and we have to figure out what life is about by examining our dreams or our thoughts and so forth, as though our nature is in some way hidden from us, that we have to look for clues and find something that is secret and hidden. Maybe that's why human beings love mysteries, because in some ways we're mysteries to ourselves. But the mystery that we are really seeking to know is who we are and who we really are. And that can actually be discovered through meditation. There are two types of quiet sitting meditation. One is called shamatha, or tranquility, and the other is called vipassana, or insight. Shamatha calms the mind. In vipassana, we look at the mind and try to determine what it is. And we do this with good old-fashioned analysis. We allow our mind to come to rest in meditation, and then we take a moment to take a peek at it and see what it looks like. We ask ourselves questions to help with the examination. We'll say, well, this mind, what is it? Is it a solid object? Is it made of molecules? Is it made of atoms? What's it made of? What color is it? What shape is it? Where does it begin? Where does it end? And where is it staying right now? You can ask these kinds of questions about your mind. And newsflash, you won't find any of those things. You won't find the atoms or molecules that the mind is made of. You won't find the color, shape, location, beginning, or end. And in so doing, you will experience an illumination that is beyond intellect, that is beyond anything that you could possibly know, K-N-O-W, anything you could possibly know. And that illumination is what you might call the ultimate illumination, the ultimate understanding of your mind as being both non-solid, non-existent in a material sense. It's not made of atoms or molecules, but yet full of continuous manifestation and potential. It's a paradox. The mind is a paradox. It is not a thing, and yet it's not nothing, because it knows and experiences things. And so being able to rest within that paradox is a way of being able to understand the nature of everything. Because the things outside of us, we already got them mostly figured out. Science has already got most everything figured out. We know about atoms. We know about molecules. We know about neutrinos. We know about all these kinds of physical components. But we also know that they are not here the way we think they are, that they're all continuously decaying in front of our eyes. I mean, things are falling apart. It's just going really, really slowly. And if we think about that too much, it might make us a little bit nervous. Like, how long will this chair that is underneath me last? Is it going to last through the end of my talk? Will I suddenly be sitting on the floor? And the answer is no, it's going to take many, 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 many years for that to happen, for that decay to occur. But the opposite, the other side of that is, should I cling to this chair? Should I think that this chair is some sort of absolute source of happiness? Should I cling to my chair other than just to keep my bottom off the floor? The idea is that clinging to things causes pain and suffering. This is the basic teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And so anything that allows us to let go, even undercutting the solidity and permanence of material things, can be useful. Talk about illumination. If we learn how not to cling to things, then this is actually a way of undoing suffering by undoing the cause of suffering, undoing the clinging and fixation that's the cause of suffering. Wow. Just by shining that light of understanding. Shining that light of understanding on ourselves and our minds and so forth. In fact, you could get really cosmic with this whole thing. And this will be my last point. You can get real cosmic with all of this and realize that the things that are happening inside your mind are happening inside your mind. And they are not actually happening out there. Anything that arises in the mind is actually of the mind, just as a wave is of the ocean that gives birth to it. So that means all of our thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, and so forth are happening within our minds, which means anything can be changed. Our perception of anything can be changed. And in changing our perception of things, we cling less, we suffer less. You see where this is going. So no matter what tools you use to bring about this letting go, whether you use the tool of quiet sitting meditation, letting go of all of the repetitive habitual thoughts, letting them all go, you can use that tool. You can use the tool of compassion meditation, imagining on the out-breath that you give happiness to beings, and on the in-breath, imagining that you remove suffering from beings, that it dissolves into nothing and disappears. Or if you use the tool of mantra recitation, reciting simple mantras such as the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om Mani Padme Hum, depending on how you learn to pronounce it. Reciting mantra, and doing compassion meditation, and all of these things are ways of undercutting our tendency to habitually cling to everything. No matter what tool we use to learn to let go, if we use that tool, we will feel lighter. And that's a different kind of light. We won't be as weighted down with our intellectual falderal. I love words, don't you? Isn't English amazing sometimes? I mean, falderal. Wow, that's a word. Hubbub. Falderal. Kerfuffle. I actually, when I worked at the newspaper, I actually had to look up kerfuffle because I had never heard it before. It means conflict or, you know, anyway. Kerfuffle. Man, great. I love English. It's just fantastic. And I could spend all afternoon talking about really cool words, but we won't do that. We will just shine a light momentarily on the beauty of the English language and spend the majority of our time talking about the mind and how it works and how it produces our experience and how we can be a light unto ourselves. This was the teaching of the Buddha. Be a light unto yourself. That's what he taught his disciples. Be a light unto yourself. That means that we use this mind, which is both the cause of our happiness and our suffering. We use this mind, which is the creator and undoer of our habits. It creates the habits, it undoes the habits. We use this light of our mind. We use this mind to illuminate our experience, illuminate our lives, and to shine a possibility, a light of possibility for others. So if we can do that, then making a physical lamp is a symbol of that. And this is why on Buddhist shrines you'll see lights, is that sometimes we need a little help in shining a light on ourselves. Some days we feel sad. Some days we feel incapable of seeing our Buddha nature or meditating or doing mantra. But if we can put that little lamp on the shrine in front of the Buddha image, it will illuminate the Buddha in front of us, at least for a moment. And in so doing, create the potential for us to see the Buddha nature that's within us. It's just simple interdependence. The Buddha taught that all things are related and connected, and that's how they work. So I could keep talking, but that might not be interesting. So maybe what we could do for the next few minutes is do some have some discussion. The question microphone is open for business, and you can ask questions either about what we discussed today or anything. So the question microphone is open for business.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Hey, thank you for being here.
So I have been noticing lately that when I enter into interactions with others, the habit, the initial habit, is always to think about how that's going to make me feel. So if I'm entering into an action, an interaction with somebody that I like, that I'm comfortable with, you know, that I'm excited about, or something like that, there's always one kind of feel to it, a kind of light that I bring to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go into it nervous or intimidated or whatever other range of emotions, then I'm bringing a very different energy to that. Sometimes I'll be mindful of that and I'll recognize that. And I'll stop and try to reorient, saying, may this interaction I'm having with that person benefit them. And kind of try to adjust it so that I'm changing my my intention. Any advice on how to remember that? You mentioned Thich Nhat Hanh instructing his students to bring a smile to their interactions, and I think of His Holiness the Dalai Lama that talks about you just see it whenever he meets somebody. He's totally engaged and interested in them. That's kind of any advice on...
I really appreciate you bringing this up, because I think that every time someone asks a question at the microphone, I'm always thinking, man, I'm glad they asked that. Because there's usually two or three other people in the audience who are thinking about this. And I think that what you have described is sort of the human condition, isn't it? We want to bring our very best to any interaction. And so thinking about it in advance is usually what we do. But as you say, if we're intimidated or feel fearful or have anxiety, all of those things will come out and flavor the interaction, because other people, that's the cool thing about people. We pick stuff up. I don't know about that. I don't know about you, but like I pick stuff up from other people, and that influences me as well. And I think that is an example of how easy it is for a feeling to key into and to prompt or spark an emotional reaction and a habitual emotional reaction. And we become so habituated to these reactions that they kind of get built in. So that I'm going to use a weird example. Like, so whenever you, if you go to the dentist and it hurts, you don't want to go back to the dentist. But now, of course, they have medications that will help with pain, so it still makes it easier, but it doesn't mean we still like it. Don't you really feel sorry for people who do blood draws at hospitals, because nobody wants to see them coming, you know? But if those people can bring these types of positive attitudes and habits, that's really good. And so you can maybe play a game with yourself. And the two ways you can do this is before the interaction and during the interaction, because you have to practice in advance before, really, to ideally. When we see the athletes who perform just amazing gravity-defying feats, when we see them at sporting events or acrobats who perform for entertainment, they don't just walk into the performance space and perform. They actually practice a lot outside the performance space so that when they are in the performance space, what they are doing looks effortless and almost magical. How did that person do that? And I think that spiritual people need to do that as well. So I think the best thing we can do is practice when we are not in the presence of people who cause us to feel fear and cause us to feel intimidated. When we're not with them, then if we can imagine that we are with them and that we can imagine that as we breathe out, we give them happiness and so forth and so on. If we can do that, that's a really positive thing to do because it will help us set up a different feeling about them. Or we can think about how much they're suffering, like that person is really suffering and that's why they act this way. So I'm thinking that if we can practice in advance of the frightful situation or the anxiety-producing situation, if we can practice in advance, this gives us confidence. Even if it's the confidence in the neutral and safe environment of our home where we practice meditation, we can feel safe in that moment. So even if we start out anxious, we can then recover more easily. And I think that's the thing, because once we recover once, we realize we can recover, right? And we realize that it's a possibility. And once we recover once, it's like, okay, I can make this happen again, and so forth. Does that make sense? It really does come down to having that. And sometimes you have to reason your way into it. You have to think, you know, if I get anxious or freak out in this situation, it's not going to help that other person either. It's not going to help me. It's not going to help them. So you know what? Right now, I'm going to send that person a lot of good energy so that I'm doing my best right now when I'm not with them. I'm doing my best to make everybody feel good. And you can send good energy to yourself too. You can imagine yourself being more calm and breathe out and give yourself a sense of peace and calm before you go into an interaction. And that will help also. But the other thing is to recognize that we can't control what happens. That's really, in the end, is knowing that we can't control the outcome of any situation. It's when we think that we can control the outcome of situations that we get the most anxious. Like, I want this to come out a certain way. And the tightness of wanting it to come out a certain way all by itself, it's like trying to carry an egg that's not hard-boiled. And if you carry it in your hand with too much force, you crack that egg. But if you hold it too loosely, it falls out of your hand. So it's like learning how to carry an egg, is learning how to recognize that the world is going to happen to you, but that it doesn't have to change you.
Right. I've really noticed that there's such a grasping for my feelings. I mean, I mention it in context of interactions with others, but with regard to practice, you know, if I start interpreting my practice as how is this going to make me feel,
mm-hmm.
versus the intention of why I should be doing my practice, mm-hmm. to benefit others,
mm-hmm.
How I spend my time, if I'm doing something right now and would prefer to be doing something else, then I end up unhappy because I'm grasping after this feeling that tells me there's something I wish I were doing more than what I'm doing now. Things like that. So it's part of a bigger pattern than just interactions with others. But since you were talking about the
right.
shining with others, you know, it's really been on my mind lately.
And I really appreciate that, because knowing how something is going to make you feel, it does, and dwelling upon how something is going to make dwelling, that word, I love English, dwelling upon, you're living there, dwelling upon these feelings that you think you might have. It's like, you know, it's like writing in the sky. It's writing on thin air. It doesn't, nothing stays there. And if you can remember that sort of image of trying to draw on thin air when you're trying to, how is this going to make me feel? It's just like drawing on thin air. So the idea is that if you can recognize the dwelling upon it before you go into it and make the aspiration that may whatever happens here be of benefit to me and others. Just keep going with that. Because we don't know what's best. See, that's the thing. You know, people say, Buddhists, why do Buddhists even bother to pray? There's no God out there that's going to answer your wishes because the Buddhists don't pray to God. And I say, well, depends how you define God. God may not be a person in Buddhism, but the idea of the all good, which is not personified as a person, does exist. We do have that concept of goodness that is absolute, which is enlightenment. So, but Buddhists pray for what is best because that's a way of opening up to and accepting what is happening. Because being okay with whatever happens is kind of a good thing. So, I appreciate it. I'm sorry I couldn't give an exact answer today, but we had a good discussion.
These are just
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Hi, Mama Catherine.
Hi there. Hi.
My first Dharma talk that I've
fantastic.
Tuesdays. I love the.
Thank you.
The compassion.
Thanks.
My question's around the compassion that comes from the darkness. Something I've always imagined. If everybody reached our true Buddhahood, and we were all in the light, what would happen to compassion, and how would we invoke that amongst one another? So should we embrace the darkness and the light, or is it to completely eradicate the darkness?
I think that someone asked my teacher once whether there was going to be a time in the future when everybody was enlightened. And he kind of smiled and he said, he said something to the effect. He didn't use these exact words, but he said, theoretically, it's possible because everybody has Buddha nature. Theoretically. The likelihood, theoretically, yes. Likelihood, maybe not. And so I don't think we need to project ahead as to what that world will be like, but to find fault with that world that might happen in the future, because it's theoretical. But what we do know, is that in our own minds, when we dispel the causes of suffering in ourselves, when we dispel those causes of suffering in ourselves, we don't become less human. We become more human because all of those things that prevent us from showing our humanity to others, those are dispelled. All of our jealousy, all of our competitiveness, all of our hatred, all of those have been dispelled. And when those are dispelled, all that's left is this heart of love. It's actually the natural byproduct in the process of enlightenment. This is written about in the Buddhist texts. So we won't need to have theoretically in the individual. So I'm talking about theoretically in the individual, not theoretically in the universe, but theoretically in the individual when all of the causes of suffering are abandoned and the nature of mind is seen and a person becomes a Buddha. They actually are naturally compassionate because they see all the other beings who haven't understood that. And so there's this natural compassion, very much how we would feel if we came upon a group of infants or toddlers playing with toys, if we came upon them, and we saw them fighting over a toy, and we would think, aw, isn't that adorable? They think the toy is the most important thing in the world. And you feel like this natural love and compassion for their confusion. And so that's how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas look at us. They don't hate anything about us. They just see, you know, they're trying, they're going to overcome like that. But I'm not sure I've addressed your darkness and light question. Am I getting close?
Yeah, the natural inclination to be compassionate towards one another. Probably something I can't comprehend in my current state, but it makes complete sense that we would naturally have that compassion towards one another.
Mm-hmm. I think we've often looked at friends or relatives and say, you know, they just don't understand, and that's why they're suffering so much. They think that this thing is really important, and it's not. And so we can feel compassion for that. Is that getting closer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because yeah, I don't want to, I may be misunderstanding your darkness and light analogy, so if I still haven't quite hit it, let me know.
Just one last clarifying. So the desire is to completely dissolve the darkness within ourselves. There still be a means for balance.
Let's put it this way. They said that, this is why I think I didn't address your question. Because I want to make sure I understand this. So you're thinking that there are two forces at war within an individual, darkness, the forces of darkness and evil and the forces of light and good? Okay. Yeah, I get it. Okay. Yeah, so I didn't think I addressed your question. Now I can see that I didn't. Yeah, I got the first part right. Well, I got some good news and I got some bad news. First of all, our basic nature is not at war. There is no war. There's only goodness. Darkness comes from not seeing our goodness. It's not that there is a dark force out there in the world, like a demon or a devil. Yes, the Buddha talked about Mara, or this negative idea, this negative, he calls it a being, but it's not really, doesn't even exist like that. Mara is not seeing our Buddha nature. So it's not that there is a war going on with the individual. The only war that goes on within the individual is us against our goodness, against all of our habits. So it's not that there's a war and we have to dispel this evil force. It's not that we have to counteract the evil eye or the evil force, but we have to continuously become aware of and strengthen our confidence in the good. Does that make sense?
Yes. Back to the original state.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah, because it's sometimes is called the natural state. The natural state of mind where there's no clinging and no fixation. Which it's not easy. That's why they call it the practice of meditation and not the perfection of meditation. Although it's very interesting that you've said you've attended the Chenrezig practice, because in the Chenrezig meditation practice, we imagine an enlightened world, and then we imagine our goodness fully manifested as the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, and then we dissolve all of that into utter emptiness, and then realize that in the next moment, after we've dissolved it all into emptiness, that we could re-arise as that goodness is that Chenrezig. And so it's we rehearse that over and over and over again, and it gradually has an impact. In fact, we just found out that that's going to be the topic of Kempo Urgen Tenzin's teaching when he comes the first weekend in March. He's going to talk about creating that sacred world within ourselves by rehearsing over and over again through mantra and visualization. So awesome. Okay, no, thanks for your question. Yeah, I'm sorry. I give long answers. If you're okay, we'll take these two questions, okay? Yeah, those will be the last two.
This should be quick.
Okay. Not if you ask me.
Yeah, well.
If you ask somebody else, yes. If you ask me, no.
Me too.
Yeah.
I just actually wanted to share a couple things. One is thank you so much. This is wonderful. The other thing was 30 years or so ago, I putting myself into a position, into a job that required a lot of phone calling, and I am not comfortable doing phone things. I talked to somebody who was really good at it and asked him how you get really good at it, and he said, well, every time that you answer the phone or every time you make a call, stand up and smile before you speak.
Wow.
Because by doing that, or maybe sitting up straight would be good too, it changes you. It isn't just that you bring something directly to someone who can see you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true.
Right.
So it made me think of Thich Nhat Hanh,
who had
this meditation called Smile Down, kind of beginning shamatha by smiling at yourself, whatever you think of, like the top of your head or your belly or the way you feel, whether it's good or not, which reminded me of the talk you gave a few weeks ago. And you mentioned, which is like taking care of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what they're doing, you smile at them because they're a little funny and you love them.
Right.
And I felt like you brought that all together today, and I just wanted to, I think it's so important that I just wanted to acknowledge it and even amplify it. So thank you.
No, thank you.
You created the causes and conditions for many wonderful thoughts in my mind, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just paying it forward, you know. Somebody asked me about Kempo Karta Rinpoche, who's the founder of the center. And, you know, I've been with him so long, he knows actually where all of the skeletons are in my closet. He knows every single one of them and has probably polished a few. But he's really, yeah, I'm just paying it forward. Whatever he gives, it's like I just keep handing it out. So thank you. It's just like everybody going out and doing the good thing is like, what my friends in 12 Steps say, just, you know, take a deep breath and do the next right thing. Yes.
Thank you. I'm smiling.
I love it.
Perhaps a theoretical question that's not important, but this moment is so incredibly small. Is it possible that in such a small moment, we might be awake, and then it goes away. So we might be actually enlightened for infinitesimal time?
Yeah, it's possible. Theoretically, it's possible. And in fact, in the Tibetan teachings, they talk about certain circumstances that have to do with our physical body. One is when we're falling asleep. I think that's the easiest one to talk about. When we are falling asleep, we actually pass through briefly a state of awareness that if we can rest in that state of awareness, the result is enlightenment. And this is why in the three-year retreat, the retreatants are taught to go to sleep sitting up and meditating. Newsflash, it doesn't work most of the time. I'm just saying my experience. Newsflash. But theoretically, it is said that we pass briefly, and I mean infinitesimally briefly, through that experience because of what happens in the physical body when we fall asleep. We withdraw from, as we are falling asleep, we withdraw from our engagement with the senses, the eyes, the ears, and so forth. We withdraw from our engagement with them, and then the mind becomes quiet, and in that quiet, brief moment, before we pass into dreams, and then we pass into the dream state. And although the dream state is really interesting also, because the retreatants are trained to recognize that they are dreaming when they are dreaming, which is similar to being in an argument with someone and realizing that you're the one who's being the idiot. I'm just saying. So.
Well, I can relate to that last.
Okay. We've all been there.
And I thank you so very much.
No, thank you. I really appreciate all of the goodness that you brought here today. And again, it's just so great to have everybody here. And thank you so much for coming and putting your energy into this room every week as you do coming and being here. So thank you. And just as my friends in 12-Step keep saying, keep coming back. Just keep coming back because we're here. We're going to be here. And again, just a reminder, we'll be at the Center for Pragmatic Buddhism on Tuesday morning at 7 a.m., and we'll probably be there for a couple hours, so show up whenever you want. I remember somebody the other day came into one of the talks near the end, and it's like, yeah, just come on in. It doesn't matter what time you come. I'm happy. These things don't worry me. So just come on down anytime.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of bagels, so we need a lot of you.
Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. Well, then I am not going to miss that.
Crazy.
Yeah. So thank you. That's the man with the plan. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. If anybody has a 4-slot toaster, see me. Yeah. We already have one there, but we need one more. So, okay. Let's sit quietly for just a moment and dedicate the goodness of our session. We dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings see the light that is within them and be a light to others. May they become Buddhas and may they emanate everywhere and bring their light to the universe. So we will mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.